Ace Podcast.
This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Hey everybody, what you're about to hear is our second ever crossover episode. This time we hung out with the guys from the What If podcast. We had a great time, but just like last time, we just didn't feel comfortable asking people to censor themselves when coming on the show. So, there is some strong language in this one. We've gone ahead and marked this one as explicit, but just in case that slipped past you, we're just giving you a little audible warning now. Other than that, enjoy the show. It's a fun one, and make sure that you go check out the What If podcast. They are truly, truly worth your time. Hello and welcome to the What If You Are Not Alone podcast. I'm Sam Fredrickson.
Hey!
Hi, Sam!
It's Ryan and Spencer!
It's Ryan and Spencer! All right.
What's happening, dude?
I dig that.
Jason Whitehouse.
There you go, Jason. So this week we are merging our podcast to create one massive, beautiful podcast explosion.
We're crossing streams, if you will.
Crossing streams.
Yeah, I'd like to say that we're just like, merging. It's a fusion.
There we go. This is a hostile takeover of the What If podcast.
Of each other's show.
That's what this is. There we go. We're just trading ownership. So yeah, figured it'd be cool to have every. Thank you, Jason. It would be cool to have everybody together, and we are just going to talk about one of the craziest things you've ever heard.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
This is the closest our show gets to just total absolute bullshit, and we're always really close. But I think this is the one where we actually cross over into just total,
you ride the line,
total BS.
Yeah, I feel like that's pretty,
dude, I don't know,
pretty
we got
close
a lot of electricity
us.
It's maybe in the air.
there's a feeling, an electrical feeling in the air. Yeah, it's I mean, it's up to you, you know, let the listeners decide,
right,
of course, as
right.
Always, if you want to believe it's true
it's
or not.
It's a classic.
Jason says
we've got the government, we've got crazy experiments during the Cold War. It's great.
We've got
it's
aliens.
World War II, but that's good.
Yeah, I thought it was 55. Am I incorrect? Was it World War II? Not
the experiment took place in 1943, and then it all kind of came to light in 55, 56.
Jason Moitoso, horrible researcher.
I don't know if it's horrible research. I think it's just not
rolling
researching.
Off the seat of my pants.
Let's not get too far ahead of ourselves here.
What are numbers and years?
Okay.
Who needs them?
We should tell people the actual name of the thing that we're talking about today.
We are talking about the Philadelphia experiment.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, buddy. Crossing that line, yes.
Let's do this. I'll run through the really quick version of the story. And then, Sam, you can get into some of the backstory and the murkiness. Does that work?
I dig it.
Murky, like the ocean.
Mike, the
exactly.
Ocean.
It's a boat.
What a fabulous segue.
That was a water-based pun for you, Jason.
Oh, that's my whole, like, thing today, as I'm going to try to make as many sailor jokes as I possibly can. Oh,
thank you.
Great.
The joys of working with Jason Moitessa. All right, take it away, my dudes.
All right. It was indeed 1943. It was October of 43, and the Navy carried out, this is all just put allegedly before and after everything I'm about to say.
One big quotation mark at the front and one big quotation mark at the end of this entire episode.
The Navy carried out this experiment in a shipyard in Philadelphia, and their goal was to try and make a ship undetectable by radar. And they were going to do that by creating a strong electromagnetic field around the ship. And it worked. The ship could not be picked up by radar. But it also had the unintended side effect of making the ship invisible, like just to the naked eye. So as they start doing this experiment, they've got these crazy generators creating electromagnetic fields around the ship. It starts to disappear. There's a green hazy light that appears because sci-fi. And
because Ghostbusters.
Soon the whole ship fills with this green haze, and the ship, along with it, everyone on the ship, start to disappear from sight until only the water line, like the water that the ship was displacing, was visible. So you couldn't see the actual ship, but there was this big indentation in the water. In addition to disappearing, the ship also teleported from Philadelphia to Norfolk, Virginia.
Which, because sci-fi. Yep.
Tell me sure, more.
That makes sense.
Which was also cool. It was a success, I guess, even though they didn't intend to disappear or teleport. They successfully did both.
If I teleport and I end up in Norfolk, Virginia, I'm going to be so bummed out. I'm going to be like, there's so many other places that I could have landed that would have been amazing.
In addition to that, a lot of the sailors on the boat got just real, real fucky when they came back. Sorry, I said I was going to keep it PG-13, and my brain came up with the word fucky.
Sorry, that's literally the word I used in my notes, so you're all right, man.
So they came back after they had disappeared and time traveled and teleported and whatnot. They came back, and some of them had merged with the ship, so they reappeared like halfway into the deck of the ship, or
things were a little discombobulated upon reappearance, I think.
Yeah. Some of them were.
Talk about going down with the ship, right?
Some of them maybe also traveled to other dimensions where they encountered aliens and teleported through time. So,
I mean, of course.
Time travel and teleportation is essentially the same thing.
It is essentially the same thing. So, yeah,
right.
Obviously.
So I think that's the shortest version we can probably get to.
Yeah. And now we get to tell why and how we know all those things and whether or not those things are even.
It's probably because they've been added on.
Sam, you want to take us through how we came to get that quote unquote information?
I will take you through. So
alleged this is our information.
Alleged information. Yes. Yeah. So essentially, you have this experiment taking place in 1943, but nobody really heard anything about it until 1955, 1956. Now, essentially what had happened is that there is a well-known astronomer and UFO author by the name of Morris K. Jessup. And Jessup published his first book in 1955. It was titled The Case for the UFO. In it, he discusses the UFO phenomena, possible means of propulsion used by anomalous craft that had been reported, the theory behind UFOs and aliens, extraterrestrials, all of that. His book was fairly popular, and he had been referred to as the most original extraterrestrial hypothesizer of the 1950s.
Ooh.
He not only had, yeah, that's a big, especially in the 1950s.
Did he get a trophy?
That's a big deal. I think no.
He was one of the first to come up with the or to at least publicize the ancient aliens idea, though.
That is true. Dear. Yeah.
He was pre Von Daniken.
He was. Yeah, Von Daniken's Chariots of the Gods was published in 1968.
Spider.
And Jessup died in 1959. So he was ahead of the curve all the way around.
Ahead of the crazy. Got it.
Ahead of the crazy curve.
Sam,
I love how we both read the Wikipedia page for the Philadelphia
Experiment. Hey, man, I do real research, and it just happens
don't
to start on
Wikipedia. Don't tell them our
sources,
Jason. Don't tell them our sources.
I love it.
My bad.
Sam, can I hop in really quick and just mention one thing about Morris Jessup that I found very delightful?
Yeah, dude.
I was looking at Morris's other books, and turns out this dude doesn't like deviating too far from the source, because book one was The Case for the UFO. Book two was UFOs in the Bible. Book three was The UFO Annual. And book four was The Expanding Case for the UFO.
He writes about UFOs.
His book titles are like one word off.
Stay in your lane, fam. You got UFOs.
If it works, don't fix it.
That's true. He found his home and he stayed there.
All right, so why is this dude important?
Yeah, what happened to Morris, Sam?
It all starts going weird when this book of his, The Case for the UFO, shows up in the Naval Research Office in Washington, D.C., mailed to them in a manila envelope that had been scrawled on the front of it, Happy Easter. And the book was heavily annotated in three different shades of ink with three unique types of handwriting and appears to be like a conversation between the annotators regarding the contents of the book. Now, it's the main reason this applies to our case in particular is because on page 27 of this book, written in the hand of the man who was identified as Mr. B, it states, U.S. Navy Force Field Experiments 1943 of October produced invisibility of crew and ship. Fearsome results, so terrifying as to fortunately halt further research. This is the first ever known, like written mention of the Philadelphia experiment ever.
Damn. Yeah,
you could trace it all the way back to this.
I think they halted the research because they needed a couple years to surgically extract all the sailors from the ship that they like found themselves inside of.
They're like, let me just take care of this and then we can go forward.
What year was this again, Sam?
The book was mailed to them in, I want to say it was 1956.
Okay.
So the original book came out in 1955. It was either 1955, 1956. And the Office of Naval or the Naval Research Office was really interested in this annotated copy of Jessup's book. So much so that they reached out to him and was like, hey, do you know what's going on here? Did you send this? Is this some sort of prank? He said he has no idea, but the people talking within the boundaries of the book seem very confident of their understanding of the mechanics of UFOs, the mechanics of space travel and time travel, so much so to the point that the government actually authorized a reprinting of this annotated version, which is now known as the Varro edition because it was paid for and published through Varro Manufacturing or something like that. Now, it starts to get even weirder, like even more hokey, wherein shortly after this, Jessup receives a handwritten letter from a man named Mr. Carl M. Allen.
Sup,
and
Carl?
This is where, sup, Carl? How you doing over there, boy? And this is where we get the majority of the information about the actual experiment itself. So Carl Allen, whose quote-unquote real name was Carlos Miguel Allende, there we go. Sure.
I think it's Allende, right?
I think it's that Allende? Y sound. Allende.
Oh, no. All right. In that case, I'm going to stick with Carl Allen.
His name was Carl, so he probably pronounced it Allende anyway. That's true. Fine.
Yeah. There we go. Just wonderful. Exceedingly white. I'm going to go back to
Colin. We're from Idaho,
Colin.
So I mean, whatever.
Yeah, that's true. So he claims to be an ex-Marine who, after his service, joined the Merchant Marine and was assigned to the SS Andrew Furuseth. Now, he had seen the experiment firsthand on the Norfolk side, seeing the Eldridge appear and then disappear just a few minutes later. He claimed to have never necessarily been intimidated by his superiors, but he was also never given a good explanation to what he had seen, and so he started his own research and was essentially writing to Jessup to try to get his ideas on it, get his feedback, see what he thought. Now, Allen claimed that the experiment had taken place not only as a way of creating this physical invisibility and time travel, but also as a way of testing Albert Einstein's unified field theory. So let's pause here. Who wants to talk about unified field theory? Because it is way over my head.
Ryan does, but just before we get to that, have any of you guys actually read the letters from Allen?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't see them. I didn't know we could read them.
Yeah. Well, if you can read, you can read them.
Well, I didn't know that there were photocopies of it on the internets that I could have taken advantage of.
They are like pretty almost wild, indecipherable nonsense.
Ooh.
Perfect. I'm not really sure how they got some of this information out of them. Like, it starts, your invocation to the public that they move en masse upon their representatives and have thusly enough pressure placed at the right and sufficient number of places where a law demanding research into Dr. Albert Einstein's unified field theory may be enacted 1925 to 1927 is not at all necessary. That's the first sentence of the letter.
Nice.
What does that even mean?
I have no clue, and it's all one sentence.
It's open to interpretation.
Yeah, and that's
probably why we got so many things going on there.
I read three, I think the three of these letters that have survived, I read those, and it is hard to understand stuff, but you also realize that he has his own way of speaking. And that's why when Jessup got this first letter, he's like, this is the guy from the book. The guy from the book is writing this letter. It's not just some random wackadoo. It's a dude. Well,
it's a very specific wackadoo.
He's a random wackadoo. It's a specific wackadoo.
It was this guy who had annotated the Varro edition of his book. So yeah, it's crazy. On our side, we'll post some links in our blog post to where you can find those letters and like the Varro edition.
Yeah.
It's interesting stuff.
We'll do the same. Sam, tell everybody who's listening to our show where they can go online to find your show.
All right. You can go online to find our show at notalonepodcast.com.
Sweet.
This one will be like notalonepodcast.com/Philadelphia. What about where can the people listening to our show go to find your show?
They can go to whatifpodcast.com. Hey.
Nice. Whoa. Nice. Look at that.
Teamwork.
It's easy to remember.
Bizarre.
Are you guys ready for science lessons with Mr. Copperood?
Yes, hit me with the science.
All right, kids.
I am so ready. I got my coffee here. Let's do it.
I'm ready for more science. Let's talk about science.
I'm putting my white scientist coat on, and I'm putting my pocket protector in.
They're called lab coats. You're off to a great start.
Nailed it.
I like this mental image.
What about your goggles? You got to protect your eyes.
Yeah,
you
okay. Goggles on.
Protective eyewear.
I got a beaker in my left hand.
Do you even know what a beaker is?
Like the Muppet?
I have a Muppet puppet on my left hand right now. I figured that if anybody should explain to the group what Einstein's unified field theory is, it should be the dude who dropped out of physics in high school because there it was way too fucking hard.
Perfect.
That person is me. So I'm not going to get into the actual nitty gritty of it because speaking of reading Wikipedia pages, if you read the Wikipedia page for this, it will break your brain. And I don't want to speak for any of the listeners. Some of y'all might be very up on this game, but I'm going to break it down into like a very, very basic level. So essentially, unified field theory was a theory that Einstein had and attempted to prove, never successfully, and still has not been successfully proven to this day, that essentially states that everything that govern, all the rules that govern our understanding of how the universe works, can be interlinked in what we could almost look at as like a single equation, right? So light, gravity, matter, all of those things, E=mc², etc. All of those things could be basically placed into one equation because the theory is that they are somehow interdependent on each other in a way that we haven't fully understood yet. And Einstein's unified field theory was that because these things are all sort of interconnected, if it is one singular equation, there might be ways that you could tweak certain parts of the equation and get different
variables.
Yeah, tweak the variables and you could actually get a different outcome on things like gravity, matter, and light. So the concept is basically speaking to the idea that, if they were trying to make a ship disappear, if they were studying unified field theory, what they potentially could have been trying to do was look at a big equation and go, if we mess with a couple numbers over here and a couple ways we treat some things over here, can we get light to react in a certain way where, oops, it doesn't see that ship anymore? So that's sort of like the very pedestrian take on how unified field theory works. I'm not going to pretend to even drop like a single scientific word in that explanation, but conceptually, that's sort of how it's explained.
Quick clarification: there is not a unified field theory. It's a hypothetical.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's never been proven that this is in fact the case.
And I think on an even more fundamental level, the idea is that the four fundamental forces of gravity, electromagnetic, strong, and weak can be combined into one equation, basically.
Yeah, that's like basically what I just said, dog.
Yeah.
You gotta trust your co-host, just, man. He covered it.
Yeah,
man.
That's the same thing.
Sure. I was listening.
I heard a little exactly more dropout language, but like, you know, yeah. I was like basically there.
All right. Yeah.
No. He's right. He's right. His clarifications are indeed correct.
Yeah. But I mean, like, it kind of makes a little bit of sense using electromagnetism in order to kind of bend light rays around the ship in order to give it the appearance that, you know, none of the rays are hitting it to reflect off and into your eyes to give the appearance of being invisible.
Right.
Time travel. Like Harry Potter does it. Just essentially, teleportation becomes a hairier situation. Because the amount of energy you have to input to do that is ridiculous.
How would you know?
Jason fancies himself a bit of a scientist, everyone.
So I actually came across the Philadelphia experiment when I was doing research on time travel for our Tales of Time Slip episode a few months back.
That makes sense.
And it was ridiculous. it would take a lot of energy in order to essentially create a portal. Really, what you'd have to do is increase the speed of essentially the ship's movement to near light speed in order to create that kind of travel.
So you gotta get a really big sail.
A really big sail. And it's also weird because the closer you travel towards light speed, the longer light waves become. And so typically what would actually happen is like white light would fade away, and really you wouldn't get a green haze, it would be a blue haze all around you because the blue light waves pull and become much larger and everything that's in the ultraviolet essentially drops because of how fast you're moving.
Science.
Does it ever become does it ever become a purple haze?
Because
there we go. Good question. And
no,
technically,
it wasn't. Don't dignify that with good question.
White light would go purple and then fade completely away because you're going too fast and you can't see it anymore.
All right.
Nice.
And I think that in the terms of the Philadelphia Project, the main thing that they were kind of hoping to exploit, I guess, as from the little bit, I as well am not a sciencey dude. I did make it through high school chemistry, but I also have a confession. Mr. McClendon, I cheated. I cheated on every single assignment, every single test, and I am sorry for that, but I had to do this. So the little bit that I understood is that it seemed as though they were trying to use the electromagnetic force to manipulate the force of gravity, because especially when we look like out into space, the force of the gravity of the sun will actually bend the fabric of space enough to bend the light slightly coming around that. So they
kind of like a wormhole,
but they were hoping to do it at even a bigger thing so that it misses the sun, or in this case, the ship, exactly, which
again, the energy the sun puts out versus the energy mankind can put out.
A ship is a lot smaller than the sun, though, right? So it should be a little easier.
Yes.
If we're looking at it in that case, and they're bending the fabric of space-time in order to manipulate the light, it could just be like a side effect that the ship does get displaced in time. Now, I'm not saying I believe any of this.
I mean, I'm just saying. You gotta think, if that's the case, then
I listen to a lot of Neil deGrasse Tyson Star Talk, so.
If we're bending space-time in the fabric of it, we're probably creating a different gravitational pull then as well.
Okay.
So the fact of the matter that the boat literally just sat there in the water anyway, and nothing else happened. Nothing.
That's not true. Guys ended up inside the ship.
Teleported.
I know they teleported, but I mean, like, there's no exterior, like, no other environmental change.
Just the
besides for the ship itself changing is what I mean.
Okay.
Nothing else was being influenced.
I dig that.
That'd be the weird thing.
They started messing with the strong and weak forces, and people's particles got all rearranged, and some of them ended up back inside the ship.
Yeah, they got bonded together.
Yeah. Exactly. Oh, man. Terrifying. Cool. Well, that was a great three-part explanation of unified field theory.
I think we nailed it, guys.
I need that sounder from Billy Madison after the spelling bee.
Where he's like, "We are all dumber for having heard your response. I award you no points, and may God have mercy on your soul."
Thank you. That one. Yeah.
That's beautiful. So Alan claims, you know, we just mentioned that the unified field theory has never been proven. Alan claims that that is straight disinformation. It was in fact proven, and it was this unified field that allowed the teleportation through time and space and the cloaking of the ship.
Yeah, man, it's the government covering it up again.
Exactly, just like they are wont to do.
Every time.
Quick side note, I think for our listeners and your listeners, everybody needs to go watch Unacknowledged on Netflix.
You stop that.
It'll wreck your life. It's all about the government covering up, and oh, dude, it's so good.
And then we'll talk about it next week.
All right.
Let us come back when you guys do.
And I'll tell you.
I have some thoughts.
Have you already seen it?
Yeah, Spencer and I went to a MUFON meeting in Minneapolis.
Okay, well, that's not the best place to like view it. You need to view it in a different setting than MUFON.
The content remains the same, my friend.
That's true. It got me, man. I was just going to be honest. Anyway, all right, going forward here. So now, essentially, what Alan claims is that the field that was generated was a sphere, an oblong sphere that extended about 100
obviously
yards.
Obviously, doesn't know what a sphere is shaped like. It's a sphere. It's an oblong sphere. Always, that's not a sphere anymore.
Always with the semantics. All right.
Just call it a bubble.
It was boat shaped.
It's a bubble. It's a boat shape. It's not a boat shape.
It's a Bodie McBoat shaped bubble.
Bodie McBoat shaped bubbles.
Oh, man.
Beautiful. And this oblonged shape extends about 100 yards off from tip to tip of the ship. Now, those experiencing from the outside of the sphere, they could only see the displacement of water formed by the hull of the ship.
So wait, if the sphere was around the ship mm-hmm. and extended past it, why could we still see the water that it was sitting
dude,
in?
Dude, you let me finish the sentence. You'll have another question, I promise. From the inside.
Tell him, Sam.
From the inside, those who look down saw that they were walking on nothingness. So the
is that
kind of
like walking on sunshine?
but they could still see and interact with each other. What so why was the ship invisible, but they were not invisible? That should be your question. I'm going to let you answer that.
It's just bullshit. It's just,
hey, man.
All it is.
That's the right conclusion, but it's also no fun.
Information.
That's often the problem. Jason is usually
obviously
right
because the boat
but has no
can't
fun.
See the sailors. It doesn't have eyes.
There we go. That is the right answer. So Alan claims that about half of the people on the ship immediately went mad, just completely went insane from this experience alone. He also claims, kind of like we mentioned, that people are getting trapped in bulkheads. Some people disappear and never came back. But the other really specific thing he mentions,
those guys lucked out,
right? They didn't have to deal with any of this. They also would do something he called freezing, or going frozen, or going blank. And essentially, the individuals would find themselves completely unable to move and stuck in time, essentially. Now, whoa. He says that at one point, it took up to 6 months to get one of the people unfrozen from this. He also includes a public service announcement, which states that if you are near the Philadelphia Navy Yard and you see a group of sailors in the act of putting their hands on a fellow sailor or upon thin air, and you see it seem to waver a little bit like a heat mirage, you need to run over there right then and put your hand on whatever they're touching. Otherwise, that guy may never become unfrozen, and it's all your fault.
So it's like a Congo line.
It's a Congo line of pulling people out of hell, essentially.
It's a Congo line. It's a Congo line with way more dramatic consequences. Most Congo lines are like, hey, we're just going to awkwardly like move until someone slips on the hardwood floors and knocks Granny over. But this sounds like
oh no!
This sounds like a conga line that could potentially never unfreeze a person from time space.
I'm exactly. not gonna lie. If I see an image wavering back and forth, I'm gonna question my own sanity before going, oh, obviously I need to touch that dude.
That's real. I mean,
cement him into reality.
Why do you not just automatically want to touch anything that doesn't seem normal? Is that
well, Sam? I've learned from Prometheus that if I touch something that is not normal, it could kill me.
Ah, that's fair.
And probably will.
I could dig that. So
horrible, horrible scientific movie.
Beautiful. Now,
just being in this field has the ability to completely and totally alter a physical state of being, even after the field has dispersed.
Wait, does that like turn me into the Human Torch? Do I become a plasma?
Oh, dude. Dude, you just said Human Torch. Again, you just got to listen here for a second. You're going to answer your own questions, I promise. So
tell
one
him,
man
Sam.
Was...
I'm on the edge of my seat.
One man was said to be able to walk through walls after the experiment, but the other thing that was supposed to happen on the Human Torch side of things is that men who were said to go into the deep frozen state and not become unfrozen would spontaneously catch on fire.
Sure.
And they would burn to death. Not? They would burn to death for up to 18 days. It took them 18 days to
no,
die.
No, it doesn't.
It could have if time was all messed up, man.
First off, you know
you how don't know that.
Crazy it would be for your atoms to phase through another object?
You don't even care about the people burning to death for 18 days in stasis.
Well,
that's fine.
No, like, that's not how it works. that's not how burning to death works.
Have any of you guys watched the 1984 Philadelphia Experiment movie?
I intentionally
God, no.
did not.
Oh.
Is it good?
No, there's but you should absolutely watch it.
No. Is it like really cheesy?
Yeah, it's like a B movie.
Ooh. Straight is it straight to like video?
I don't think so.
Theatrical.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's based on William Moore and Charles Berlitz's book, The Philadelphia mm-hmm. Experiment. And it's the 80s effects of the guys like burning and phasing in and out of reality and disappearing are worth watching. It's on YouTube. It's free. You should watch it.
All right. Wow. There we go.
All right. Free movie. I'm not going to say no to that.
No, I'm doing when I'm drunk.
There we go.
All right. Mom, I don't get drunk.
So
nice.
Who's going to believe
Are you like
that?
17?
No.
Okay, good.
24, but still.
All right, cool.
Yeah. But mom, he doesn't get drunk. It's
Often.
Fine. The thing about these letters, though, that Alan is sending Jessup is they're full of information like, oh, if you just contact this person or that person or this person, you know, you'll find your answers. And essentially, Jessup chases down all of these leads and not a single one turns out to be a true, real thing that's happening.
No.
You don't say.
All of them. He tried all of them.
Every
Good
single
for
one.
Him.
Now, on March 25th of 1956, Jessup receives a letter from Alan, and it seems, due to the content of it, that Jessup had essentially said, like, hey, you need to give me real proof. I'm really getting sick of this wild ghost chase and goose chase trying to track down all this stuff that's just not happening. I need real proof. And Alan responds with just this rant. And essentially what he's saying is, listen, I will give you real proof. I will give you indisputable evidence if you will give me a hypnotist, sodium pentothal, which may or may not be recognized as something that used to be believed to be like a truth serum, a tape recorder, and a typist. He claims that he would be willing to undergo hypnosis while on sodium pentothal because in his mind, he believes that people can't lie on sodium pentothal. They can't lie under hypnosis. So he has to be doubly honest in that
doubly
case,
honest.
As well as use that to identify other people who were there with him on the ship. And then like he has this whole big plan because then he wants to grab those people and put them under sodium pentothal, under hypnosis, and like just let the correlating accounts of all of these people speak for himself. And of course, Jessup says that sounds a lot like assault, and I am not going to do this. The last piece of evidence that Alan claims is that there was a basically a newspaper article, and he said the exact newspaper, the same issue, even like the location, he's like, it's in the upper right hand of the fifth page or something like that, that talks about a raid that happened in a bar room wherein like invisible people came in and drank all the booze and left. And it happened right around the same time as the Philadelphia experiment.
Whoa.
That was his. Yeah,
so
man.
So he was saying like invisible sailors got off the boat and we're like, we're getting fucked up.
Exactly.
If you guys have watched the movie, you know all about this.
That's a bit stereotypical.
Dang. I should have done some research on that. That would have saved me a lot of time. And that was pretty much his last big hurrah, like last big, this is it. And Jessup from there just says, you know what? I'm done with it. This is just a waste of time.
Smart man.
And Jessup goes through and he tries, he's like, you know what? Let's just publish more UFO books that all have pretty much the same title, except with one word changed. And let's try to make a living off of that. Unfortunately, his other books aren't as well received. His wife leaves him. He gets in a serious car accident. And
oh, wow. That's downhill quick.
Yeah, it was a bad.
It gets worse. Yeah, just wait, Jason. It gets worse.
Just wait, Jason.
Oh, man.
He has a bad 3 years. However, for one reason or the other, it's April 19th, 1959, and Jessup makes a call to a Dr. Mason Valentine and arranges to meet him the next day, claiming that he made a breakthrough in regards to the Philadelphia experiment. The following day, never showed up. His body was found in his car with a hose attached to the exhaust in an apparent suicide. Despite initially being investigated as a homicide, there was no autopsy. And conspiracy theorists will say, like, oh, they offed him. He got suicided because he knew too much. But in reality, he had been talking to his friends and family being like, I'm really sad and I would like to die for months before this. So,
and then he never had a bad year again.
And then he never had a bad year again.
Well, I mean, let's think about it. If Frank Underwood could do it, then the government could.
That's true. I mean, that's true.
Also, what kind of dick friends just hear a guy say he wants to kill himself and be like, all right, cool, great, have
that's
fun.
True. So, that's true. It is the 1950s. Like, people were not very, I don't know, understanding, I guess, in that time.
I also kind of feel like... I also kind of feel like there's a big part of it too, where if your friend has also been talking about disappeared ships and his correspondence with the crazy person and invisible sailors drinking booze and UFOs for like their entire life, they'd be like, yeah, this dude talks about a lot of stuff that isn't really exactly what it is. So like, he's going to be fine.
Well, he showed them.
Yeah.
I guess he did show them, in one way or another. Sad end to the story. I don't mean to like make light of it. It's a sad end to like, cause the thing about it that I keep thinking about, well, should we take a break and then should we come back and talk about what we actually think happened in this situation?
Hey guys, heads up, we take breaks on our show.
Oh yeah. We take breaks
on your show.
Holy shit.
That must be nice. Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, everybody stick with us, and we'll be back in 1 second with the What If You Are Not Alone podcast. We'll see you in one Woo! Sec. Yeah, so we're back talking about the Philadelphia experiment, and I want to know what the Not Alone dudes think actually happened.
Can I?
Oh, Spencer got one.
I want to take us in a slightly, like, because we stopped at, what was that, 59, Sam?
1959?
Yeah, 59.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because this story persisted for a really long time.
To the point we're talking about now, right?
Take us through it.
Yeah, just quickly, in 74, the story showed up in a book by Charles Berlitz called The Bermuda Triangle, and he was somehow trying to tie it into stories of ships and airplanes and stuff disappearing in the Bermuda Triangle. So it got retold in this best-selling Bermuda Triangle book. 5 years later, in 79... Berlitz and William Moore wrote a whole book called The Philadelphia Experiment, Project Invisibility.
Mm.
That, again, like all of this is coming from Carl Allen's letters. So it's now been in two books. 5 years after that, it got made into the 1984 movie. A bunch of people after the movie came out said that they had information about it.
Ooh. Mm-hmm.
And so that's where you...
No!
Dude, it gets a lot weirder still. Just hold on. Al Bielek and Duncan Cameron were two people who said that they were on the SS Eldridge in 43 when this experiment happened, and that they jumped off of the ship because they started getting freaked out that they couldn't see the ship and each other. And instead of landing in the ocean...
Wait. Hold on. They jumped off the ship that they could not see.
How do they know they jumped off the ship? What if they're
because
still
they
on
landed
the ship,
in 2137, bro? They went time
Whoa!
Traveling.
Whoa.
Yup.
They swag surfed their way to 2137.
Dang.
Where then Dope. They also traveled to Mars. They went to the year 6000 to retrieve some dark matter.
Oh, good for them.
And eventually ended up at...
what do they do with it?
You know,
we have no way to use it now.
And they probably do in the year 6000, Jason. They got dark matter ships all over the place.
Tell them, Sam.
That's great. You got this. Dude, if we have a hoverboard by the time year 6000 comes around, I'll be happy.
You'll be dead.
Will I?
All right, that's fair.
Dude, I'm a Terminator, bro.
But Duncan and Al Bielek ended up in 1983, finally, at Montauk. And if you guys want to Google Project Montauk for a real bad time, we're gonna probably cover it in depth in a future episode.
Yeah.
But the Project Montauk and the Philadelphia Experiment are linked because of these two guys that claim to have been on the Eldridge, jumped off, time traveled, and ended up in New York in the 80s. Also, they got reincarnated in different bodies somewhere along the line, too.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
What a fun ride, man. Oh,
and then Duncan Cameron's job at Montauk, he sat in this really cool chair, and his job was to manifest things in real life from his brain.
Oh, dope.
And the project got shut down when he...
So he's the Green Lantern.
When he manifested an interdimensional Bigfoot that started destroying stuff. And then they shut the project down.
What a dick move.
I know.
Duncan, not again.
Come on.
So anyway, that's how that story keeps hanging around.
Yeah.
I love that.
It's wonderful.
It's the thing about it is, like, an invisible ship is not that unique of a concept. Like, I mean, that's the thing we've talked about. So the fact that it's subsisted for such a long time is kind of fascinating in its own right. Like, why this particular iteration of that trope?
Because it has UFOs and time travel and teleportation and conspiracies and government cover-ups all mixed in. That's
true. I guess there's a little extra to it, too.
Yeah, it's like clay just keeps getting added to it, and it just keeps a beautiful
sculpture of madness.
The thing about the madness, too, and like this is kind of what bums me out about this story, is like, man, it's kind of a bummer that dude offed himself after this whole incident, because it didn't even happen to him. I mean, it happened to him in that he got letters in the mail, but like, that's a shitty thing to happen to you, that you just get enough letters in the mail that you go crazy. Cause it's like, cause that's what I don't know. It's like, did he get the letters at all? First of all, like,
yes,
he did get them. I mean, he didn't just write them and then go, check out these weird letters I got. I'm being talked to by someone who's part of a government experiment.
No, he definitely got them.
Okay.
Yeah, I've got some stuff about that.
All right. So he definitely got them.
I would just love to see his response to all this after that. Yeah,
that's the half of it that we still don't have. Like, he kept his letters, but he didn't make a copy of the ones that he sent out.
Yeah, well, I mean, just like how he would react to how it has essentially grown in the years. He seems, besides for writing about UFOs all the time, he seems like he did his due diligence a lot of the time, especially for this story. So it'd be interesting to see like what he called BS, because he did essentially do that in the beginning of the story, and then it has turned,
went back to it. Yeah.
So it would be interesting to have seen how his opinion would have formed over time with it.
Yeah.
There was part of me that wondered whether or not his like bringing of this to light and exposing it and talking about it was like, I'm gonna sell some more books. Like,
right.
Well, I mean, probably.
it's somewhere in there.
I mean, like the other two dudes that, you know, talked about being on the ship after the movie came out. I mean, come on.
Oh, no, they're 1,000% full of shit.
I will say, Al Bielek did have a PhD in physics, okay, so I don't know. But then again, that's like my least favorite, I don't know, is it a fallacy? It's my least favorite argument of like, well, this guy was a smart dude, so he couldn't have snapped, right?
Yeah, he couldn't be crazy.
Smart people never snap, right?
But yeah, so what do we know about Carl Allen? Do we know anything about him? Like, was he actually the things he says he was, like in the army, etc.? We just don't think that he actually ever saw a ship and then didn't see a ship.
Right. So did you guys come across in your research at all the Anatomy of a Hoax by Jacques Vallée?
Yeah.
I don't know that.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah, it sounds cool. I don't know that.
Okay. It is fantastic. So like, for anybody who doesn't know, Jacques Vallée is the man. He is one of the forefront like UFO researchers who has the ability to call BS. And he has done amazing work trying to not only figure out exactly what's going on here and now, but also like tying it back to like folklore and mythology and all of that, not in the Ancient Aliens kind of way, but more in the like Jungian, like, oh, ETs may just be like manifestations of our subconscious, but while also saying that something is actually happening. He's a fascinating dude. And he wrote it's like this 25-page paper called The Anatomy of a Hoax. And that it was released on the 50th anniversary of the Philadelphia experiment. And in this, he lays out like 12 different factors that are exactly why this hoax still exists, and like why people still talk about it and think it's real. Everything from like the specific details to the socio-political climate and stuff like that. It's extremely well done. But in this paper, he drops like two big bombshells. And the first one is about Carl Allen. And what a lot of people don't realize, we do know a fair amount more about Carl Allen now than obviously they did back then. He claims that he never recounted the story. And even in 1986, there was an article ran in the News of Colorado Centennial Country, which like he made this big final statement about all the things he had seen and how they were all true. He claimed that Jessup hadn't been killed, but rather instead that Jessup had killed the government agent sent to kill him. Ooh. And like turned it on its head. Yeah.
It's like Mission Impossible status.
Mm-hmm. And he gives like, and that they like work together. He gives Einstein like this kind of diabolical mastermind thing where this is what Einstein wanted to happen. He just didn't want to tell the government that. And so he's like, yeah, we're just going to do some magnetism stuff, and was just overjoyed to see his field theory work out. And then he studied under Einstein for the rest of Einstein's life. And what a lot of people don't realize is that in 1969, this guy, Carl Allen, walks into the Tucson office of the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, and notarized document says it was a hoax. I made it all up.
What? So, really?
Yeah. Yeah, dude. He Damn. Went back on it later in life. Like he immediately like had this, oh crap, what did I do? I'm not going to be relevant anymore, and went back on it. But Valet was able to uncover this, and he's like, well, that pretty much takes care of Carl Allen. And it turns out that this, because essentially he had put a return address on one of his letters, and it was like supposedly this creepy abandoned farm Ooh. In the middle of wherever. And people are like, oh my gosh, it's just like a front. It wasn't a creepy abandoned farm. It was his farm and his family. His family lived there and worked there. Yeah.
He just had a shitty house.
Yeah. Don't be so mean to this guy. He can't afford a great farm.
Yeah.
Jeepers creepers.
He'd have a bigger farm if he could.
He did. He was just this normal dude born in Springdale, Pennsylvania. People like his family and friends was like, yeah, Carl was really smart, but he never applied himself at anything other than making jokes and like pulling people's legs about things
and writing 14 page letters about invisible ships in Norfolk, Virginia.
Exactly. And that was part of the element of the hoax, was like this super official sciencey sounding stuff that to the layperson sounds legit because we can't like understand the underlying theory. And so we're just going to gobble up whatever people tell us about unified field theory or anything else like that.
Can't prove it's not true.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well,
then the other big bombshell that he drops is the testimony of a man named Edward Allen Dudgeon, which Dudgeon was an electrician's mate, third class in the Navy. He had all the documents to prove it. Whereas Allen died a drifter, essentially. He never could prove that he was a Marine, that he was in the Merchant Marine Corps, that he was in anything at all. And for all intents and purposes, it looks like he just came out of this with his own head, just making stuff up left and right. But this guy Dudgeon, he did join the Navy. He actually faked his papers. He joined the Navy when he was 16, and he was stationed on a ship called the Engstrom, which docked in the same area as the Eldridge. And one of the core things that was going on was that these ships actually did have secret equipment on board, but it wasn't for time travel or anything. It was to pretty much just to degauss the ships so that they wouldn't be attracting magnetic torpedoes and just making sure that everybody stayed safe, but not anything crazy sciency. And like the Eldridge and the Engstrom did separate from a time, but when they came back to the same port.
Well, I mean, can I?
Yeah.
Sorry. For that's still an impressive bit of technology.
When oh, you got yeah,
a
dude.
Bunch of German U-boats.
Yeah, dude.
That it was were sinking worth, our battleships fairly easily.
It was worth so, I mean, hiding that's still for sure.
Absolutely. Very. Yeah.
Yeah.
So secrecy makes sense.
Yeah, 100%. Like, it makes sense it's, for yeah, what they again, were doing it's, to be it's classified.
An impressive technology for the time period.
Yeah.
So I don't think that should be understated.
It was dope tech. Let's just all agree on that, okay?
Cosine.
I hate you.
I love it. The other big thing, though, is, of course, this idea that there was this infamous invisible bar fight, which is so embedded into this. And what it comes down to is that Dudgeon was one of the soldiers there at the bar when this fight breaks out in this tavern in Philadelphia. For one thing, it changes from being like a group of invisible soldiers walk in, drink all the beer and walk out to there were these soldiers who started fighting and then they suddenly went invisible and nobody could find them. And really what it was
Fight Club.
It was Fight Club. No, it wasn't Fight Club.
It was that they left.
Tyler Durden.
Because they were underage.
Exactly. Yeah. It was that these hostesses were like, oh, these nice kids are in the Navy. Oh, I don't want to get them in trouble just for having a beer. Like, and so they did. These hostesses were just like, they vanished before our eyes. And everyone was like, sounds so legit. That sounds so legit.
When they really
legit.
Just pushed them out the back door.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And like the last thing about it, the only last thing is like, well, why did people in Norfolk claim to see it? Which who knows if anybody actually claimed to see it other than Alan, because that journey from Philly to Norfolk takes 2 days by sea. But the Navy used this like hush-hush inland channel that only took them 6 hours round trip. And so people couldn't understand how it could have gotten here and there in 6 hours instead of 48 hours. Turns out it was just a normal thing that happened all the time.
Turns out the Navy's just like, sneaky.
Yeah, just like very, everything very else in this. So like that's my, if we're talking about what happened, that's my opinion on what happened.
But what about the time traveling guys who jumped off the ship?
And then
I think they
manifested an interdimensional Bigfoot inside of Montauk.
Yeah, explain that one, Sam.
God, that's so good. I don't know.
So real.
Jason, you want to take a crack at that?
Almost like it didn't happen.
It's almost like
it's just so unbelievable. It's amazing.
There we
and
go.
Completely, yeah. Utterly not true.
I don't want to say that they lied. They might
did.
Have believed
they for
it.
Sure oh,
they
for sure did.
They might have believed it.
We, the three of us, will. You don't have to say it. We will.
All right. That's fair.
Yeah. This one is one of those, like, it's, it will, I guess what Spencer was saying earlier about the whole, like, This is as far as we go in terms of like things that are real far out there. But it's weirdest to me that this one has had so many things that have continued to bring it back to life over and over again. Mm-hmm. Books and papers and stories and movies and for there being like such minute actual evidence, not to mention the walkbacks of actual testimony and telling of the story eventually. Mm-hmm. Like the fact that it's just subsisted as a trope in this world of strange things is kind of funny and fascinating to me.
It's interesting to look at how information gets disseminated too. From this all can be traced back to one source,
right?
Who has said I made it up, but mm-hmm. now all the other information is still out there. You can still go buy books about it and find websites about it and find newspaper articles about it that didn't get retracted just because Alan said, oh yeah, I made all that stuff up.
Real, I think it has like all the right combinations of things. Mm-hmm. You've got, it came out in the 50s, mid 50s, where we had UFOs and kind of government conspiracies already forming. And then you look at a story that a teleporting ship from, you know, World War II always seems to have, at least for myself is always an interesting era. Mm-hmm. And I think the combination of that, and you've got these really weird letters and all this documentation that seems kind of crazy and out there. I think that is what really brings it around and keeps bring it back to life over and over and over. I think the big question for me is like, why? Why do that? I mean, obviously you put a ton of effort into giving this hoax life.
Stringing that dude along for years and
yeah, think, did he just like not like the author or something? You know,
I think that the fact that
back in the '50s, that's the way to do it. It's how you catfish.
I think that the fact OG. That we're thank you, Jason. I think the fact that we're talking about this and the fact that I've said Carl Allen's name like
12,000 times, 12,000
times in the last Nailed hour. It. I think that that's like all the motivation. The dude died penniless and alone on the streets of Colorado somewhere, like, and yet we're still talking about him like
60 years later.
Yeah, for some people, mm-hmm. that's all they want. That's all they need out of something like this.
And I think the thing,
a legacy.
Yeah, and I think the thing that that has taught me is I got to start writing some letters.
Mm-hmm. I got to start
making some shit up and writing some letters, you guys. Why I'm trying to get this legacy this? Going.
Yeah, isn't that what this podcast is?
Yeah, that's true. That's totally what we do.
That's fair.
That's fair. That's why I'm here. I'm scared to death. That's literally like I want my life goal is to live long enough to get like artificially implanted into a robot.
You are terrified of dying, that is, aren't you?
Oh,
is that
horrified.
Why the Matrix scares you so much?
Oh, so much.
Because what if you're not even alive to begin
exactly,
with?
Exactly, man.
Oh, dude.
Have you guys done an episode on the singularity?
We haven't talked about the singularity.
Oh, you
yet.
Totally should.
I have that book by Ray Kurzweil, The Singularity Is Near. It's sitting on my shelf as it has been for like 3 years, just staring me down.
You want me to just burn it? It'll take 18 hours, I promise.
It was 18 days, bro.
18 days. Oh. Dear Lord.
It's a big book. It's a big book.
What are they
book.
Made out of? Pure fat? Book. Like whale blubber?
it's Each page is an actual whale.
Dear Lord.
Jason, have you seen Chappie? You should watch Chappie.
I think I've heard, maybe.
It's so good. It's so bad, but
what's
it's
it
so
about?
Good. It's about like this little robot dude and then DeAnt.
No. Yeah.
And like
it's,
they have their
by the guys
times,
that did District 9 or whatever,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
No, never watched it.
It's about like taking your consciousness and putting it in another dude's body. No.
See, I
putting
sometimes
it in
you just got
body.
Put in another dude's body, you know?
That's all. That's all.
Ghost in the shell. That's what I want.
Well, I think we solved it.
I think we solved it, guys. Yo, this has been a super fun crossover episode. Thanks for being down to do it with us. We've been a fan of your guys' show for a long time, and you guys said some nice things about us, which was very nice of you. Thank you for saying nice things.
You're welcome, dude. Thank you for having a great show. Like,
no, it's the same to you guys, man.
What was I doing? I was playing Horizon Zero Dawn the other day, and I was listening to, because I'm still working through your back catalog. I just found you guys like a month ago, 2 months ago. And there was this one episode where you paid some guy, or some guy may have volunteered to make songs off of David Icke.
That's our buddy Eric. Yeah.
That was the highlight of my year so far.
Wow.
It's beautiful. So like, yeah, anybody listening to this, if you haven't checked out What If, go check out What If. It is, you're going to love it. I guarantee. Even if you don't like us anymore, you're going to love them. They're good. Yeah. Like, I was explaining to Jason, I was like, these guys are funnier than us. They're probably smarter than us. They're the better version of us.
Hell no. There's no way.
You guys are
true.
Way better looking, which is what really matters in podcasting.
I can believe
there
it.
There we go. It's a visual medium to be
fair. I love no, it. By the time I'm done with it.
You guys rock, man. Y'all keep up the good work. Maybe we'll have to do this again sometime.
Yeah, dude. We're down.
One more time, tell everybody where to go find you on the internet. Shout out anything you guys want to shout out.
We have the internet. We have the website, which is notalonepodcast.com. We have Twitter, Not Alone Pod. We have Facebook, Not Alone Podcast. What are you doing? You're like making faces and
or you know, you could just Google
Jason
us.
Jason just likes to
just
say Google us.
Google me, baby.
You can see it everywhere.
Yeah, you
choose
could.
Your preferred method of contacting us.
But
or following
that's making
us.
Them do an extra step, whereas I could just do all the steps right now.
See, I'm just giving them choices.
So. There we go. The illusion of choice. I'm gonna say that again.
You do one thing and you get 12 different options. It's great.
All right. Facebook at Not Alone Podcast, Twitter at Not Alone Pod, Instagram at Not Alone Pod. You can email us at notalonepodcast@gmail.com. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, everything, whatever works for you there. And what about you guys? Where can we find you?
Yeah,
Google us.
Google me.
Yes. Yes.
Now we're at whatifpodcast.com. You can find our Patreon and all that stuff there. We're also at What If Pod on all the socials. If y'all have episode suggestions, and by y'all I mean Sam and Jason, send us an email at hi@whatifpodcast.com, or anyone who's listening can send us episode suggestions there too.
Really quick, because I've been excited to share this to our listeners. Email us at that if you have a spooky story. We're going to do our first ever listeners special sometime in October. And if you want to record yourself telling it, or just send it, and we'll pick some, and then we'll have a buddy from work come in and read the ones that people don't want to tell themselves. And then next week we're doing Skinwalker Ranch. And if you need a good, like, other show to listen to about Skinwalker Ranch, I might recommend the What If Podcast, because they just did Skinwalker Ranch. So yeah, man, it's gonna be good from here. That was a plug. is this not just an hour and 15 minute long plug at this point?
Yeah,
I love it.
You guys better be ready to do a two-parter on Skinwalker, because there's a whole bunch of weird shit.
Just two? I'm ready for three.
You say that.
Go nuts, man.
We're doing at least three, Jason.
Oh, God.
So
why?
Enjoy. It'll be good. It'll be good. But yeah, cool, guys.
All right, dudes.
Yo, fun shit. You guys take care, and we'll see everybody next week.
I love it.
We'll do that.
I love it.
Okay, bye.